Hello, welcome to episode 26 of Harmonious World. This time I'm joined by mandolin expert Avi Avital, and I am really excited to be talking to him. Thank you for joining me on Harmonious World. I'm really grateful.
Thank you. With a great pleasure.
First of all, let me just say, I absolutely love this album.
Thank you so very much. It means a lot to me, really, because it was it's an unusual album for me, and I was quite curious to see how the world will accept it. Yeah, so it really means a lot when you say that.
Yeah, I mean, Art of the Mandolin. I have never really thought about the mandolin as a... I mean, I know it's a serious instrument, but you know what I mean?
Exactly, and everyone thinks like that. I mean, that's the beauty about the mandolin. And I think that, you know, the mandolin, everyone kind of have an idea about the instrument, but it's connected to different cultures, to different genres of music. So it's actually beautiful that every person, also when I perform around the world and people come to me backstage, and they would often say something like you said. I mean, I never thought of the mandolin as this and that, which is gorgeous because it means that they thought of it as another thing. It means that it has a lot of associations and connotations that are wonderful tools to use in your art, in my art, in the composer's art, and so on.
Yes, indeed. So on this album, it's got a really eclectic mix.
I mean, normally all my other albums are pieces. I recorded many pieces that were written for the violin originally. I perform normally music written for the violin. So it's a little bit, this album is a bit the opposite of that, because in this album I said to myself, I'm going to only perform and record pieces that are written originally for the mandolin, so that composers really sat in their studio and thought about the mandolin. Unlike what I normally do, which is playing other instruments music.
So I absolutely love the Salima prelude for solo mandolin. That is far and away my favorite piece.
Oh, that's great.
Stunning.
You know, I was curious before the album came out. I was curious to see what would be the most favorite piece. Every album has that. And Salima, indeed, to my not to my great surprise, but to some extent, it surprises me that it has become the most you know, popular, I guess, or one of the most popular tracks on this album. Well, Salima is Giovanni Salima is a cellist and a composer and just a wonderful musician and a good friend of mine from Sicily, and we bonded really on this. On this kind of Mediterranean identity kind of thing. And the piece, it comes through the piece very much because it references very clearly to the South Italian dance, like folk dance, the pizzica, the taranta, the tarantella. It has different names. But essentially, it's a static dance in 6/8 kind of rhythm, which is the seed of this piece, which it makes it a lot of fun to play as well.
Yeah, it's stunning. It's stunning. And then, of course, and the other piece, which I kind of love, but it's so dark, the David Bruce, Death is a Friend of Ours. It's so deep, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. David Bruce is a British composer and one of my favorite living composers. So between Salima and David Bruce, really, if your listeners haven't had a chance yet to know them, you're in for a treat. So David Bruce, it is not the first piece I play by him. He's folkloristic. He has this thing in his music, in all his pieces, which has strong elements of folklorism, but without being obvious about it or without referencing to a specific tradition, which then would be a crossover, but it's not. It's just new music that has a kind of an ancient feature in it, which is a great accomplishment for a 21st century composer. And so this piece, I commissioned this piece for a grand finale of a concert that I was asked to do in the Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg, which was all around the plucked strings. So it included it featured all the plucked strings family in the classical tradition. So the mandolin, of course, the harp, the guitar, the harpsichord, and the lute family. So in this case, it's the theorbo, but the different kind of lute instruments. And so I wanted the finale for this concert to involve all five instruments together. Obviously, there was no piece existed for this unusual ensemble. But I said, okay, I know who to ask. And I asked David Bruce. And when he first sent me the PDF, the first PDF with an email, and I saw the title, Death is a Friend of Ours, I was like, oh my goodness. I asked for the grand finale, a jolly piece, a big bang to end the wonderful concert. And what is this going to be? An impressive piece. And, you know, I just read through the score and it's all the opposite of a depressive piece. It's jolly, it's upbeat, it's happy, it's rhythmical, and it's wonderful. It just grabs you, it's uplifting. And indeed, this is very interesting reference that David did to these instruments, to some more ancient folk traditions. There are references of the, of course, the guitar, but the harp there is a little bit like the African kora. And in other words, for me, it resembles kind of the non-Western approach to death, but more a pagan, more kind of the Day of the Death in Mexico, these kind of traditions where you celebrate the death, where it becomes kind of a celebration of life and not a depressive, sad thing.
Absolutely. It's almost like the New Orleans, you know, those things where it starts as a funeral march and it ends up being just crazy. You know?
True, yes. Nice.
Yeah. I'm a bit fangirling about this album. I get sent loads of stuff and I listen to loads of stuff and it's like, yeah, okay, this is nice. This is lovely. But honestly, this blew me away.
Oh, nice.
I started off as a pianist and mm-hmm. clarinetist, and then I've moved on to the saxophone.
Oh.
But I've always struggled with the concept of stringed instruments because I've never understood, because it's easy with piano, clarinet, saxophone, you know where you put your hands, and if you put your hand in a certain place, you always get the certain note. And mm-hmm. I've never kind of understood how you can be so precise on a stringed instrument just by changing the length of the string. I obviously understand the physics of it, but I kind of can't get my head around it. And this is the first album that has made me kind of think, oh, maybe I need to go and buy myself a mandolin and start to learn it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is actually, the mandolin has always been an amateur instrument more than a concert instrument, than a solo instrument, throughout generations and in different places. And that's because it is so intuitive, actually, to produce sound. I mean, what is more intuitive? You see it with kids, that to see a string, whether it's on an instrument, but or on a bridge, or on the thing that slices egg, and just pluck it with your hand to make sound. I mean, this is so immediate and intuitive way to make music. I think that's what captured me as a kid to this instrument. So it's really, it has something very easy, very user friendly about it, actually, more than the violin and the cello. My goodness.
Yeah. Well, perhaps I'll do that then. Perhaps that will be my my new lockdown instrument.
Oh yes.
So you were saying that this is the first time that you've put together an album that's just pieces for the mandolin. So that must have been a little bit scary, because some of this repertoire is unknown to people. A lot of it would be unknown to people.
Exactly. I mean, it was scary because also the mandolin doesn't have a lot of repertoire. I mean, most of the great composers, when you think of it, did not even bother to write for the mandolin. We don't have so many examples of composers we all know that wrote pieces for the mandolin. So first one is obvious is Antonio Vivaldi. He wrote two very famous concerti. And that was really my point of departure, because I thought to myself, when I collected music for the album, I said to myself, what are the best 60 minutes of mandolin repertoire in the history? So Vivaldi was an obvious choice. And then it was quite challenging to find the rest. And there I had a second question that I posed to myself, because there were some repertoire that was written by composers who are mandolin players themselves. So there is this phenomena, a little bit like the guitar, where mandolinists or guitarists write for their instrument. It kind of stays in the community of the players. It's being played in competitions, in mandolin competitions. It plays in mandolin festivals and so on. But because these composers didn't write for any other instrument other than the mandolin, even if they're very, very talented, they never really made it outside of the community of mandolin players. So there are a few pieces there that I play in recitals and then I liked by kind of, let's call them mandolin composers. But I realized collecting the material for the album that is less interesting. Suddenly what became more interesting for me is to discover the mandolin through the lenses of the composers that didn't know it or didn't live it from inside. So in other words, the mandolin composers know the mandolin very well, and this is the center of their musical life. And they don't look at it as a symbol. This is just the instrument they play. While composers out of this world always look at the mandolin as a reference to something. They must have a motivation, a reason to write for the mandolin. And so this is the thing that became more interesting for me. And therefore I decided to focus on this question, creating the album.
Great. Brilliant. It works so well. When did you record it?
So the recordings were in January. So January 2020, obviously, earlier this year. And then it started in March. And this is the first album that actually I finished on deadline because I had so much time to edit it. And I think this is also what helped me a lot through the first lockdown, because I was, I knew I have this big project which was to post-produce this album. Recording is one thing, but most of the time goes in the editing and the mixing together with the musical producers and the technicians and so on. So that really filled my, I felt like I'm still doing music. I'm still working on something big during this time where all my concerts were canceled. And that was lovely. It kept me sane, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about lockdown then. So obviously you've been working on this album. Have you been doing anything else? What else have you been up to?
Yeah, you mentioned before, like I had my lockdown resolutions, obviously.
Yeah.
And the first and the second lockdowns. And well, in general, I played a lot. So I did a lot of music. I did a lot of, going back to some, to the foundations, going back to technique, revisit things with a different quality, because I wasn't practicing for the concert that I have the day after tomorrow, which I usually do. But I had this space to really go into some elements in my technique that I haven't revisited for a long time and really improve that. And music in general, I picked up a hobby that was a long time my hobby, which is playing the drums. In high school, I was playing the drum set. And so I came back to that now. I had actually found a teacher even and started to take this hobby a bit more seriously. And another type of music that I learned in the first lockdown is Greek music. It's again, it's a I have a bouzouki that I haven't used for many years. And then I thought to myself, this is another opportunity to learn a different dialect of music. So a different approach to melody, to improvisation, to rhythm, which is Greek music, which I always liked, but it was in a sense just to learn another genre of music and understand the broader sense of music through it, through just a different genre. And that was really amazing. So I also found a bouzouki teacher on Zoom, and I learned, you know, for 3 months, I was really deep into Greek music. There you go.
Fantastic. Oh, that's brilliant. And I see you've got guitars behind you. You're obviously, yeah, you know,
this,
yeah,
is the bouzouki. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is beautiful. Very good. Very good. So how did you start playing in the first place?
Well, I was growing up in Be'er Sheva. It's in the southern part of Israel. And in the local conservatory, there was this amazing teacher that taught mandolin and actually founded a youth mandolin orchestra. So kids together playing mandolin and mandolas and guitars and classical music, which was really kind of the town's pride. One of my neighbors happened to be a kid in these orchestras. So he was older than I. And, you know, when I was 8 years old, I kind of wanted to do the same. It looked like a lot of fun. The instrument looked like a sweet one. And so I asked my parents also to play the mandolin like my neighbor did.
Ah, right. Oh, very good. And you live in America now? No, you don't live in America. Where do you live?
I live in Berlin.
Oh, I love Berlin.
Yes. So after my studies in Israel, you know, I graduated from the Jerusalem Music Academy. That was the the academy, the bachelor degree. And then I moved to Italy, and I spent there about 8 years. Studying for the first time, by the way, with a real mandolin professor. So the traditional technique and the repertoire of the mandolin. And then I moved to Germany, just because Berlin has become since then, and still is, I guess, a really a hub, a really important center for musicians. I mean, for classical music, this is the place to be a little bit. I mean, all the great labels are here, and the Berlin Philharmonie and all the great soloists and conductors pass through the city, and it has this energy in it that really inspired me.
Yeah.
And so this is where I still live.
Yeah, it's a fantastic city, isn't it? I first went in 1989, 1990,
oh, wow.
So when the wall was coming down.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a while in the city. And as I say, the wall was coming down, and so you could come and go between East and West Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like going back in time 30 years, 20
wow.
years, walking from one side to the other. And then I went back a few times in between, and it's amazing to see how that's changed. It's an incredible city.
Yes, it is, and it's changing all the time. I mean, I'm here for 10 years now, and I've seen it changing in these 10 years a lot. But it's always has. I always say, I mean, I lived in Italy, and it was wonderful. And I always say, like, Italy is like Florence is beautiful, Berlin is interesting. So it has something in it which is not the architecture per se, or you know, like cities are in Italy. Glorification of beauty, again, a very strong feature about Italy, which was very inspiring and important for an artist like me to live there and absorb that. But Berlin has something that is interesting. Well, I mean by that the people who live in it make it. It is about the people, the energy that is created by kind of people all from all over the world, really, and many artists and many open-minded people and thinkers and coming here and just feeding off each other's inspiration.
Which is really interesting, because if you think about its history, the history of Berlin is all about division. And obviously the whole, you know, Second World War, it was devastated, decimated. And what's come out of that, I mean, I think Berlin was always, it always had some interesting, you know, the musical life of Berlin was always, has always been interesting. But it seems like out of the division of, you know, the regime that was in place in the Second World War, and then the wall, and it feels like through the 90s and now, it's thriving. The multicultural, the diversity, the creativity is thriving almost in spite of all of that.
Yes, I think as a result of all of that, because something happened when the wall came down in 89. I think until that point, Berlin, as you mentioned, it was vibrant in different, like in the, we all say, the 30s and the music in the 20s in Berlin and so on. But the truth is that there was always a tension of the dogma here. There was always it was always the dogma ruled for, or not always, yes. I mean, for 100 years at least. So with the Nazi party, and then with the kind of the Tuber, the West and East Berlin, there was always a tension that celebrated some kind of a dogma. And when the wall came down, then my interpretation, my side of it is that as if like finally, the dogma fell also, and there's nothing dogmatic about this city ever since. I mean, there's no, almost religiously, this city is free of dogmas. At least this is how I experience it now.
It's amazing. That's my experience of it. The reason I was working in Berlin in 1990 was because I was part of the team behind the performance of Roger Waters' The Wall.
Oh, wow.
Which was held on Potsdamer Platz in June 1990. And it was deliberately chosen to be there because Potsdamer Platz was right in that centre. It was broken up by the wall. The wall was, you know, either side of it. And it was bizarre because we were working. The producer and I would walk along. We were in Potsdamer Platz. And we would walk along between the wall, and we would be saying to the East German police, can you take that bit down because we need to get a truck in there? And to the West German police, can you take that bit down because that's where the audience are going to come in? It was incredible to be to be part of that. Was just amazing. And I think when Roger Waters had the vision, he said, I think when Pink Floyd split up, he said he wouldn't ever perform the wall again until the Berlin Wall came down.
Wow.
And so that was his thing. June 1990 was going to be the time to celebrate the wall coming down at the end of 1989.
Amazing.
And yeah, great to be part of that. And so, yeah, I'm very fond of Berlin. Yeah. So lovely. What are your plans for 2021?
Well, who knows? My calendar is full of concerts. Once we resume the concerts, I'm going to be very busy. I'm performing, all over Europe and the world, actually. That's the original plan. Now, who knows? I mean, if concerts will not resume, then I will keep doing what I'm doing now, which is developing myself as a musician, working on future programs. Practicing, playing the drums.
And are you planning to tour this album? Will you be taking this album out?
Yeah, so this album is is unusual in terms of like, usually I do an album with a program and then I tour with it. But in this album, because it has different, ensembles, actually.
Oh, of course, yes.
Every piece in the album is a different, not so much because at the end, this is was also surprising for me at the end, like most of the pieces are involving the other plucked strings instruments, like the harp, the guitar, and so on. But it's a lovely program. It's just it's not really tourable. But I do play some of these pieces here and there. So in every concert now, well, Solima has become my favorite encore now. So it's in all my concerts.
Yeah.
And otherwise, I'm planning to play a few pieces in different contexts.
Yeah, very good. And have you got dates set up in London?
I do. I'm supposed to come to Wigmore Hall on April 14th. April 14th. And I think another time, also in Wigmore, on July 5th.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to do that. So
yes, indeed. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fantastic. Right. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was lovely chatting with you about this.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, well, I hope that I'll be able to see you in either April or July. And thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you.
Well, that was ending on a very hopeful note for some live music in April and July 2021. So let's hope that that actually happens and that we can all get out and about by then. Thank you for listening once more to Harmonious World. I have lots of exciting guests lined up for the new year. So please do subscribe. And if you can leave me a review, that would be great as well. So I look forward to seeing you in 2021. Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Harmonious World. My name is Hilary Seabrook, and it's a great delight to bring this series of discussions with musicians and composers and writers and all sorts of people to you. Obviously, there's no point in having a podcast if people aren't listening, and I'm very grateful to my listeners for doing so. Thanks also to Joe English for composing and performing this new theme tune. So wherever you get your podcast, you can leave a review. You can share this with your friends and family, either as a link or on social media and that sort of thing. I'd be really grateful for that. Don't forget that you can subscribe now. There's a link wherever you get your podcasts. So have a great week, and please remember why I started this, which is just to try and make the world a little more harmonious. Thanks for listening to Harmonious World.